Gregory, I'm super excited to have you on. Let's jump right into it. In the most recent report, I know it's early in the year, but you covered 14 different paradigms that you think are important for B2B marketers, for B2B brands in general. And one of the ones that you talked about that has everybody talking right now is AI. Can you tell me a little bit more around how you think brands, marketers, et cetera, should be leveraging AI to really unlock their own superpowers and where this goes?
Yeah. I mean, like my takeaway was like with a lot of the innovation that's come out, particularly with things like ChatGPT, large language models, right? This whole new universe has been unlocked in like, let's call it rather, I would say mainstream way. Like these things have been on the fringes for many years, but right. That really showed people, what the potential was. And like even in my report, right, I dug in and found some interesting survey data that was, I thought, to some degree surprising, like that so many people, in marketing say they're using AI, they're using these tools, and they're using them on a daily basis, right? Like right. It's not something they're experimenting with. It's something that they're using, using regularly, right? So for me, I think that part is quite unique. And my prediction or where I think this goes is that there's certain people that I think AI gives superpowers. And so if you're talented, motivated, you spend the time, like I think you can figure out ways to use these things and just become incredibly efficient. And I would even describe that as my own experience. Like I've been around and I've done a lot of different things too. I have a lot of talents. So I think people that are able to like, get, let's say like scale 1 to 10, get to be like a 6 or 7 in multiple areas is even perhaps what I would, recommend because right. with AI and the combination of that, you can go really far. And I think in the old days that was much more difficult, to do.
In the report, it talks about like being optimistic. And I think you had a stat in there, 54% of marketers, are optimistic about how AI can be used. From your perspective, are you optimistic about AI or are you kind of on the other side? What's your take?
Everyone knows that I'm like a super optimistic person. We even had this HR training one time where they talked about giving negative feedback. And I was like, look, I don't believe in negative feedback. I was like, challenge me. What is it? I will tell you the positive aspect of that. So that's just like my worldview. And so I'm very happy that, you know, it's actually the stat was interesting. It was like 54%. So I would say it's maybe mixed.
Right. It is. In many ways, it would be mixed. Like, do you think those who are not optimistic about it, like what would be your message to them if they want to like thrive as a marketer? Like you said, you've been around for a while. You've seen a lot of different changes in the industry. Like for the marketer who's pessimistic but wants to be in this industry for the next 10 years, what's your advice to them?
Yeah, I think that's a more interesting angle. So I like to tell a story about when I first got started. So like I'm you know, mid to late career. I got started at before the internet. I was in traditional graphic design, and I remember what people called the desktop revolution when the Macintosh was first introduced. And I was very young, but I was like an intern, but I saw a microcosm of what I think has happened in a lot of industries. And I think is repeats itself over and over. There was a group of people at the time who said, they're just going to resist. They don't like change. They don't want change. They were like literally sabotaging the equipment within certain shops. Like, it was there was a really strong group of people who did not want like digital change, but it's just inevitable and it happened. But I saw another group of people who said, hey, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to learn this. I'm an optimist. I'm going to like spend the effort, energy, time required, stay late, whatever it is. And they were all very successful. And some people had really successful careers because of that change. They were able to take advantage of it, build a new business, do something else. And so I think it's the same thing today that like resistance is futile. Like whether you like it or not, I don't know if you can decide. I think it's more a matter of like how you navigate this.
I love that. I think with AI, I like I I wasn't in the industry when they made the desktop transition, but I was in it
a long time ago.
When we made the social media transition, and I can remember going from a point where everyone only wanted to talk about billboards and radio ads, and then there was this thing called Facebook, and everyone was like, "But there's a lot of people using this channel. Why don't we spend advertising there?" In that shift, I went through in similar situations. A lot of those people who made that leap into social and didn't think, oh, social media is a fad, it's going to change the world, those people have had some very successful careers. It's a fascinating time. I think you're spot on that leaning into optimism might be the play at large. Seeing, though, a lot of the chaos in the market with layoffs, with reports suggesting that AI is going to take jobs, this is completely outside of predictions, but like, what do you do to have that perspective of optimism amidst all the chaos?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't think we know all of the answers, and there's definitely some areas that are going to be impacted in positive and negative ways. So, I think the one that's very obvious that's happened very quickly that I didn't perhaps envision at the time when something like ChatGPT came out was translation.
Right.
And so you had Duolingo quite publicly laying off a lot of translators and going to a more automated type of approach. And I know someone personally, executive, big company that had a massive translation budget and very early on was telling me like, hey, it's great. Like, we've cut back this translation budget and we're doing for the most of it with AI. And we have some human reviewers, and we're actually putting warnings on things that say like translated by AI, and they'd cut the budget down from like millions. Like, so cool that I, like I said, I'm the optimist. So I look at this and go, I think being able to translate stuff easily and cheaply is amazing. I think it has profound implications on not just marketing, but communication, right? Like, I think our video that we're recording today quite possibly could be translated into a lot of languages automatically and just, you know, vastly increase the number of people that anyone can reach. So I think that part's really cool. If you're a translator, I think that might be hard.
Right. It's interesting. I gave a talk in Brazil, and the vast majority of the population speaks Portuguese, and I know zero Portuguese. So I'm there and I'm like, I need to connect with this audience in some way. So I went to ChatGPT and I started to translate my slides into Portuguese because they were all in English, and the crowd loved it. And I think you're spot on in the sense that, like, by lowering the barrier, it's actually going to increase the connection that people have with one another. It's going to be a net positive for the world. And translation is going to have a huge part in it. In your report, you talked about personalization in AI as being a trend that you think is going to take off. And again, that drives a lot of connection. Could you tell me a little bit more around why you think personalization in AI is going to actually shake up and show up in the real world, and how?
Yeah, I think the stat was that 80% of consumers expect personalization. It was quite high. Got a lot of people give me feedback that like, wow, like, consumer expectations are high. And I was like, well, have you met a consumer? Because the people do have, people have high expectations, right? And so, you know, in the personalization side, I think it's almost like there's almost this dichotomy where there's a lot of really obvious things that AI has been personalizing for a long time. So product recommendations, Netflix recommendations, right? Like, that's very obvious. And I think it's pretty good at this point. And so you can see, let's call it the promise of where it can go. And I think that like what AI does is unlock it for a much larger group of companies and people with less budget. So like Amazon, Facebook, Netflix, these companies have, you know, vast resources compared to a lot of other people. And they've been able to like invest in AI to power those types of things. And I think that, you know, you're going to see AI for the little guy, right? The idea that other people could power recommendations or things of that nature. So I think that's one category. The area that I think for people like you and I that's most interesting will be email. Right. I think email is what's going to offer the most potential when it comes to personalization, right? Because I think that, like, you've got a lot of data. Everyone has some data set of like, I have a lot of emails I've sent out. I have a contact database. I have information at a certain scale that I think AI will be able to optimize it. And you have all these parameters, right? Like time of day, the click-through rates and the open rates, and then personalizing subject lines and personalizing email content, I think will prove to be a fairly trivial task for AI. And like, I have no idea if they're working on this, but I'm excited when HubSpot releases their personalized email tool built directly into that. And I think that's going to be the game changer. I can't imagine that they don't come out with something like I would even put at this year.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like in many ways, the idea of just doing, hey, first name is going to in many ways be table stakes in the future, because the opportunity to personalize your content on the back of AI is just going to be so much more substantial. And you're going to be able to input some more unique and interesting data. Is there anything that stands out that you've seen recently with AI that you're like, oh, wow, this was an aha moment for me as it relates to like an experience that you have with a solution or a tool?
Yeah. So an aha moment for myself. This is a really good question. Like on the one hand, I kind of feel like a lot of this stuff is still very speculative, right? That like, if you try to do some research and I took a very research driven approach, I think there's like 95% of the material out there is about like what AI might do. There's not a lot about what AI is actually doing. I did do a presentation recently about this, and I found a couple of interesting use cases. One I think you'll like. There was a CMO saying that like, it's a very CMO problem, which I like. they acquired a company, and it's all in a different brand voice. And they're like, in the old days, and I've been in this situation, you're just kind of like tough. You just kind of like leave a lot of the material. You don't spend the effort to like revise it, rewrite it, redesign it, do all of that. And they're like, hey, with AI, we just went in and like redid everything in the brand and tone that they wanted. And I thought that was actually a pretty interesting example of like, yeah, unlocking new use cases too, right? In the old days, we would have said, too expensive, not doing it. Now we're going to say, hey, we can take on this task that we wouldn't have done. And so I love the idea that like, it's not eliminating work. It's actually creating new opportunities and doing things that we couldn't do. I still think the ROI is like up in the air. That's why I think it's a very CMO problem. Like, I don't like the tone of all this, but it's cool. I think people find other examples of like, you've acquired a big library of content and you're able to easily re-engineer that in a way that is better for you. And I think that at a high level, that framework will become more popular.
Well, I think that's where I get excited about this entire thing, because if you look at it, we're still in the early days. Everyone's still figuring it out, right? Like everyone's still sorting through the tools and the use cases. And you're going to hear stories about the CMO. You're going to hear stories of a VP, of an SEO, of a strategist, all leveraging these tools in different ways, which makes it very exciting. So I love that. For the listeners, we will be linking to the report directly in the show notes so they can check it out and they can get access to it. One other piece that you talked about in the report, but also that you live with some of your content, and I've been a big fan recently with some of the stuff you're doing on social, is that idea of zero click content, where the value is given away right in the asset. For those who aren't familiar with zero click, can you give a bit of a rundown on what that means and why you think that that's a paradigm that brands and marketers need to be paying attention to?
Yeah. Well, hey, I'm glad you enjoy all my cycling memes.
And, they are good. They are good.
Thank you. They are good. It's a niche category, but I appreciate that.
But you make
that,
them relevant to like the marketers. And for folks who are listening, I'm telling you, Echo Gregory's accounts there. It's hilarious. You pick up on these memes that I don't even know really where you get them from, but they connect back to like the marketer's worldview, the culture of the marketing industry so well. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Zero click content. You know, this is a concept that I think emerged recently with algorithmic changes on, I would say, the primary like B2B platform. So LinkedIn and X, and that what people discovered, or perhaps was determined after some of the algorithms were made public, was that having links and having people click off site I want to be careful how I word this. It can penalize your reach. It's not always the case, right? These things are very nuanced, and you have to be very careful about how you interpret these things. And so I do think that everyone understands that, like, it's in LinkedIn and in X's interest for people to stay on. That if you put a link, it clicks off, right? That's very obvious. And so they don't necessarily want that to happen. And there's lots of metrics they're using to determine that, like the time on site or how the scroll, and they can measure all of that, right? So there's a lot of different metrics that go into it. I don't think it's as simple as like there's a link in here and don't do that. But I do think the concept of zero click social and not putting perhaps links into your posts is really important, because it'll really change your strategy. And I think that'll a lot of tools and a lot of the way people were focused on social media for the last, let's say, 10 years, clicks were something that they were optimizing to. And I guess like the way I would summarize this really succinctly is that I would recommend people don't optimize to clicks. And I would even go as far to say, like, for me, I think social media in very general terms should be optimized for impressions and reach. And there's two reasons I like that. One, it's universal across platforms. So if you have a lot of channels that you're working with and you can determine impressions, I think they're fairly equivalent. And then two, it works with like how the platforms are focused on optimizing content. So if you're optimizing for impressions, they're optimizing for impressions and reach as well.
Right. And when you're talking to a CMO or a leader and you're telling them, hey, you need to be optimizing for impressions and reach, how do you communicate to them that there's value in that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's funny, like the conversations I've had with people about this so far, they've been quite excited. People are like, first, usually they're like, wow, you understand the algorithm that well. I think a lot of people like, they haven't really looked into it. Most senior marketing leaders, they have a lot on their plate, right? So the nuances of like how these algorithms work. So they're quite impressed, or they're quite excited by the fact that like it's public. You have information about it. Like you can optimize it. It's changing, and like you're current with what's happening. So at a high level, people are positive. Cool. And then for me, you know, it always goes back to like, I always go back to the funnel, and I really believe deeply in using a full funnel approach. And I would apply that even to social media. So I'd say have a mix of content, have memes for reach, top of the funnel, have some great, you know, in-depth content from middle of the funnel. And then, yeah, you can put some clicks in there. You can drive people to your site. That's bottom of the funnel.
I love it. Let's double down on that just for a second. For some folks who might be kind of aware of the funnel from an SEO lens, but not really thinking about it from a social lens. Let's imagine you're working with a brand and you're talking to them about using social for the full funnel. Give me a rundown on what that conversation looks like and how you would advise them to approach it.
Yeah. So this is a great topic. We go into more depth than the funnel in general, because it's something that I've been challenged about on social media, although they've died down now, because I went on a one-man crusade to promote the funnel, because I believe really deeply in it as a concept. And there was a let's call it a trend that and I think it exists to some degree more in consumer, where people like demands everywhere, customers are everywhere, funnels are nonlinear, and you should just like optimize to clicks and sales, which I don't necessarily disagree. I just think it's more complicated than that. And what I always say with a funnel, so the idea of having top of funnel, middle of funnel, bottom of funnel, is it gives me a framework to have conversations internally and with other people in marketing to understand our strategy. And just to run down the funnel really quickly, because I think that's what you're getting at. Like, you know, it comes from AIDA, right? It's a really old system that's been around for a long time about grabbing people's attention, right? That's top of the funnel. Then in that stage, they don't necessarily know who you are. They don't know about your brand. So they need to know about it. They need to know that you're an option in the market, right? Once they understand that, then they're evaluating your product. That's middle of the funnel. Like they've got this choice or that choice. And then what happens is like at some point they decide they're ready to make a purchase. And at that stage, there's different information that's required. the most obvious thing would be pricing. So pricing is important, but in like in a complex B2B sale, there's a lot of other things that are important. And bottom of the funnel is like, okay, this meets all my requirements, it integrates all my tools, it fits all my parameters. How much does it cost, right? And that's like a, I think, a very simple way to kind of help define the funnel.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think the funnel is still a very valuable framework for marketers to study, embrace, and utilize, as well as AIDA, attention, interest, desire, action. I think that's a mental model that every good copywriter should know, but also marketers should keep in mind. One of the other pieces that you talk about in the report is around how brand advocacy is going to start showing up in a deeper way in B2B. Can you talk to me a little bit around how you believe brands should facilitate this idea of internal advocates to get their teams inspired to create and to talk and be mini micro influencers in some ways?
Yeah. And I think this dovetails too with some of my ideas about B2B influencers and influencer marketing in the B2B world. So in the brand advocacy space, I mean, I think there's a couple of different dynamics happening. Just there's so much social media now, and there's like a decline in, like, let's call it trade publications in general. And I think that all of that content has moved to social media. So there's just a lot more happening on social media in like the trade world, the news world as well. But like, I think let's focus on trades. I think it's very easy to understand. And then that is just putting a lot more emphasis on that. And so I think that like employees in some ways like don't have a choice anymore. I think you could kind of opt out of this stuff in the past. And now like there's a lot of pressure to participate as an employee just for your own career and for the company to help just have a great reputation for both hiring and for attracting customers. So I see that brand advocacy is something that I think more organizations are going to like take seriously and put resources towards, try to measure, perhaps use tools. And we've had these things in the past, but what I think is different now is like, I don't think you can have a choice to not do it. At least that's what I think is the trend.
So you're talking to a leadership team who's all in on this. They want to do it, but they don't know where to start to inspire their team to take action in this. Like, what would you advise them to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. First step is find volunteers who are excited about it. I think that like, it's very obvious, but like, it's going to be well received if you say who is excited and wants to participate and, you know, wants to be a brand advocate rather than saying like everyone has to be, like no one likes to be forced. Even if you want to do it, I would say like as an American, we don't like to be told what to do. We like to be incentivized to do things, right? So if you can provide incentives too, I think that's important. Like, do they have perks? Do they get something? Because I having interviewed the employees on this, like, and diving into some depth at one point, people want to be compensated or they feel that they should get a perk or something because like it's their social media. And the company's asking them to use their channel. So I actually think companies, I think, forget about that dynamic. And so I think that's an important part of like how you incentivize people. So first, have volunteers. Second, like what's in it for them, right? Solve that. Like some of it's just that like they get a bigger following on social media. That's valuable and they can take it with them wherever they go, if they stay with the firm or not, right? That's good. So I would start in those two areas. I'm not like big on tools. I think there's some tools that are great, but I don't think that's the holy grail here. I think it's like getting a group of people who are then excited about and are able to put some kind of like working process or system in place. I think that's the other piece. It's like, how do you share content? How do you create content? Like what are our parameters around participating? I think that a lot of like open source and very developer focused startups and companies have done a good job here. It's a small niche, and I've worked a lot of like very engineering focused, open source, like technology driven companies, and engineers are very public about like GitHub, right? It's all public. Right. Like the nature of these things is like, so in that world, they're already doing that where like employees are expected. In fact, like depending on the open source license, you're required to contribute back to the community.
True. Right.
So they actually have to give their code back. So this dynamic has existed on the developer side for a long time. And I think that that's maybe a great model for people to look at, of a customer where all the engineers and the team are like, they have their own channels and they create YouTube videos. They talk about all the things that they're engineering and they show code samples, and the company is like putting these in the newsletter. Like they're using it as part of their marketing, and they just have people on the team who are just, they're just doing that. And that's just a part of how they operate.
I think it's interesting, right? Like in many ways you want to attract and hire those types of people as well, right? Like you want to have a volunteer, you need to have somebody who has a mindset around, oh, I'm interested in the industry so much that I'm willing to share my ideas on the topic, or I'm interested in getting my ideas out there. So attracting those people is one step, but also finding them as the secondary step makes complete sense. Have you seen like this go sideways? Like a lot of people will say, oh, but if they build a personal brand, what if they leave? Like what's your counter to that narrative?
Well, what if they don't and they stay?
Right.
I mean, that's like the famous answer, right? So I've actually never seen it go sideways at all. There's always a lot of fear, but I've never seen someone posted something and it was really bad for the company. I'm trying to think back. I mean, like, so I remember when Facebook launched, right? So I do think that the rules around social media are perhaps a lot more well understood now. And, maybe party. I mean, you don't want to post and you don't want to be associated with people who have a lot of unsavory or illegal activity. But yeah, I think that's like a pretty obvious thing, right? It's for the obvious, most part.
In the early days, everybody was afraid that the person on their team is going to go out and put something on Facebook about their weekend, and the weekend was a debauchery. Like that was the fear. But now people are kind of figuring out, okay, this is LinkedIn. This is what I do here. This is X. This is what I do here. This is my little Facebook account that might have 10 people that I know and my best friends. I can do that here. And they separate those lives versus before it was like, oh, everything's social. Everybody wants to know what I'm drinking for coffee. Everybody wants to know. But now people have a better understanding of what should go where. I think that's
It's more well understood now. I remember a point where I wouldn't let people photograph me with alcohol. I don't drink anymore. Right. But like that's not even like a thing anymore, right? So I think for the most part, people understand, they understand the professional nature of it, and that, and that's what everyone is trying to do. And that's the value everybody wants to get out of it. Right. Companies like leaning into that and figuring out ways to take advantage of that, I think, is a really smart strategy. And I think bigger companies will start to do that as well. There was an example I wanted to mention. It starts to dovetail into like, B2B influencers, but like Carta, the company that manages cap tables for startups, like they've done a great job with research. And they have this guy who's like the head of insights, Peter Walker, that is releasing these research reports all the time and like representing the brand, representing the company and doing a great job. And he's not necessarily like an executive leader. He's not the CEO. And so for me, like that's a really good example of like both like advocacy and like using an influencer to help really drive their business. True. So I think it's cool. I think we're going to see a lot more of it.
I love it. One of the things that you mentioned there, and it's also covered in your report, is like how it's no longer a thing that if you have a picture and you have a drink in your hand, it's an issue. You talked about formality fatigue. And how it might drive more brands to kind of be more fun. What is formality fatigue? Let's start with that.
Yeah, that's funny. Like for me, I grew up on the East Coast. You know, I started work in New York, right? And so I remember like a pretty stuffy environment where people dressed up for work, even in hip advertising, you still wore ties and stuff, right? Right. And like the pandemic has basically eliminated the necktie. I have a giant closet full of them, and some of them are very precious to me, but like,
I haven't pulled them out for a while. I never thought about it, but I haven't pulled them out for a while.
But you got all the sweaters, so I think you're making up for it.
That's fair. It's cold here.
I think that like, it's changing, and there's a lot of reasons for this. But I think that like two things that formality, I think the pandemic, changed the dynamic of how people think it needs to be in terms of like business. So like recording videos from home, podcasting, webinars, I don't think those things were seen as like serious business tools prior. Right. I think they were like niche things. They were unique things. They were developer things. They were startup things. And for me, actually, the turning point was when Larry Ellison recorded a video on his phone from Hawaii.
Right.
I remember watching that thinking like Oracle's, in my opinion, fairly conservative company. Right. Larry's cool. Larry's been around. I would even say Larry's a hero of mine. The guy's awesome. Right. Been around a long time, but very conservative, very old school. And I think how they do their marketing. And he's the last person I would expect to like, hey, I'm here on the beach and what's going on, right? And he did a video like that. And I was like, wow, like it's changed. You know, the dynamic is now very different where he's in a more casual environment and he's approaching it in like what I would call a casual way. It's not a professional crew. They don't have makeup. They're not like making like this highly produced video. And I just think that you'll see a lot more of that going forward. Because like that invisible barrier has been broken now that you can just record videos from wherever. And the expectation is like authenticity that people prefer the real you on your phone, right? Apple is doing this now too, that they just kind of send videos internally. They don't have to be highly produced. There's just a very different perception of like how, I don't think they use them externally, but there's just a different perception of like, of what formality and professionalism means.
Right. You mentioned memes as well. Like where do memes show up in this world? Like are memes no longer just a niche subculture, or should even the oracles of the world and these larger brands be thinking about memes as a part of their content?
No, it's a good question. They show up all over my X account. So right. I can start with a, so I'm a believer. Yeah. I think, so this is an interesting one. I think it could be quite complex. So if people want to use them, and marketing, obviously, I think they're great. I have a lot of success in them. I think they're fun, and I like them personally, right?
Right.
So, if you want to incorporate in your marketing, like I do think copyright is actually a pretty big consideration,
right?
And people should think really deeply about that. There have been some like well-known brands that ran into legal trouble with it. So, depending on the attitude of your leadership team and your legal team, and the people have different attitudes about this too. So it doesn't mean that there's like hard and fast rules, but just think about what the implications are. And that's an important part because I think a lot of memes are built on copyrighted material, you know, Star Wars, like they still own the rights to that. And you're technically not supposed to do that. So, and there's ways around it. And, you know, so just have to be really smart. I think that's really, really important.
Right.
And I don't think they're appropriate for every brand. Every, you know, what their tone is. I think you have to figure out how it fits in, to the mix, I guess, like at a high level. And I think you'll appreciate this. I think the idea of the monolithic, like Ogilvy brand where it had the same tone and same voice, and it was done exactly the same way is long gone. And so I think that like, it's appropriate to communicate in the way that the channel and the community communicates. And that's how I would perhaps start. And I'd say like, look, if you think your customers are on X, there's a lot of memes on there. So I think it's appropriate. But if you're somewhere else, you know, I wouldn't publish that meme in the New York Times as a full page ad. So I think like, the channel and the audience and like what's appropriate and how they communicate. But I do think people appreciate and understand that brands communicate differently depending on the channel and depending on the audience. And I think that's cool. And that's something that, you know, makes marketing, I think, very different today than it was in the past.
It's interesting. I think a good example of this is Duolingo, like with their content and their social, like on one side, they're completely like harsh and they will rip you to shreds, etc. But then on some accounts where they know that they have kids trying to learn new languages, they are this soft Barney the dinosaur style, like tone and voice. And it's like you said, You have to understand your audience on the different channels and speak to them in the ways that, one, are respectful and make sense to them. That's what it comes down to. So I appreciate that take. I like it. And I think folks will get a lot out of that idea just alone. One of the pieces that you talked about it in the report as well was around email. And every year, gurus scream at the top of their lungs that email is dead, email is dead. But you talked about how the death of email has been greatly exaggerated. How do you see email as a part of the mix for B2B brands today? And is it exclusively for sales, or should marketers be using it as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's still a popular channel. And like, I do less email than I did in the past. So I do understand that dynamic. But the channel is still useful. There's like a formality to it. And like, it's in some ways like the only official way that certain software applications and people can communicate with you, right? Like basically every tool or everything that you sign up for requires an email address. It's kind of like your virtual address. Like now with work from home and, you know, companies like declaring they have no physical location for their headquarters, email is almost what is taking the place. Like that's my digital real estate. I have an email address, and yeah, you can find me here and you can find me there and you can Slack me and you can do all these things, but email still matters from that perspective, you know. And I think that like everyone is always declaring a channel dead, and it goes through waves, right? But it's still free, and so it's still low cost to reach a lot of people. And like we were saying earlier, I think that AI tools might unlock a lot of potential. And if things are personalized and they're personalized in a way that the content's more relevant and more interesting, I think it'll increase the value of it. Like I'm still waiting for that. I'm waiting for all of the AI generated spam that's really good and that I'm excited about and I want to read. I haven't gotten it yet, but I do believe that day's coming.
I love it. That's awesome. When you think about email versus social, like, do you see and think brands should be thinking about these as an equal split of their energy, different? Like, how do you think they should be thinking about where they invest their time and energy?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think it has a lot to do with like your audience and like your approach and what you're trying to sell. That's interesting. I guess I would say, I think so actually I would frame it as like, I'm a big fan of like ABX, account-based everything. So the idea that like your entire go-to-market team, sales and marketing, we're all one, and we're looking at everything from an ABX perspective of like, how do we target stuff to people as team, sales and marketing together? And so I think in that perspective, we start thinking of like, and this is getting very B2B, but like, I think email is overused as a channel, particularly on the sales side. Sales are like, just send out 100 emails, do 100 phone calls and leave voicemails. I'm like, I never answer my phone, right? So, from that perspective, I think like a combined sales and marketing initiative, I think social media is underutilized, actually. Right. I think marketers have embraced it and marketers are using it, but there's a whole nother layer to like, I don't know if you've talked about this, maybe the term like social selling. Is something that I think is still new and something that sales and marketing teams need to figure out. And how do you get better at social selling and use social media, I would say today, as a primary channel over email? And I don't think that's exactly how sales teams are operating right now.
100%. No, I agree. I think social selling is one of those still underinvested, misunderstood opportunities that exist among sales teams. And oftentimes sales functions operate the same way that they always have versus trying something new. One of the things that you talked about in the report that is very new is the idea of, and we talked a little bit about this, is like B2B niche content creators and brands investing in these niche content creators as a part of their marketing activities, the same way that D2C brands have done for quite some time. Where do you think B2B brands are going to go as it relates to influencers in specific niches? Is this an opportunity that you think is going to skyrocket? Do you think it's a flash in the pan? Where do you see this going in the months to come?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I'm extremely bullish on social media in general. I think, and it's like, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think we're scratching the surface of like the potential. And I think creators and like this whole new world that's been unlocked because of social media, I just think there's so much more that's going to happen. And that B2B brands will start to embrace it the way that, like you said, consumers have for a long time. And one of the, you know, data points I use was that 64% of B2B buyers are millennials and Gen Z, which is funny because people like my age, I've had to like pull that research out and show people, because people my age are like, they're like, no, it's not true. I'm like, dude, we're getting old. Like, like they're, like millennials are in their 30s, approaching 40 at this point, right? So the idea that like this generation who's grown up with creators and influencers as like their primary set of celebrities is normal to them. Right. And so why wouldn't businesses follow that? And that's why I think like social media and influencer marketing and all the stuff is like, there's a whole nother segment or world that will be unlocked in the next 10 years. And like, I'm extremely bullish on it. And I actually think that like people aren't talking about this enough. Like, you know, I think that like I wrote an article for VentureBeat a couple years ago that was titled how influencers were the new social media, social media influencers were the new celebrities. This was like 7 or 8 years ago. And I talked about the decline of Hollywood and all this stuff. And that was like very controversial perhaps at the time. And like, unfortunately, like Hollywood, I think, doesn't have a lot of relevance anymore in the way that they did. And that's why I just see like social media celebrities and this whole concept, like it's going to go to the moon. It's global. Like we're going to have instant translation. Like there's all these possibilities I could imagine. Like there's influencers who maybe are from Brazil and speak Portuguese and it gets instantly translated to English. And who knows, like maybe they become a global phenomenon in a way that we like, we haven't had in the past. So I think the future is like really exciting. And I think there's going to be a ton of stuff that, that happens there. And I'm looking forward to it.
I agree. I think it's going to be a fascinating time, especially when you look at the data, like the Grammys, as an example, has seen decline in viewership year after year after year after year. Yet the number of people who would show up to see Mr. Beast and a handful of other creators just like have a conversation just continues to skyrocket. So the shift is real. One of the other pieces that you talked about in the report that I think would be very much a miss if we didn't talk about is the fact that you talk about podcasts and how podcasts remain a leader, thought leadership frontier for B2B brands. Can you tell me a little bit more around that and what your thoughts are on podcasting and the role it, it will play?
Yeah, this is a good one. And I struggled with how to frame this. That's why I said, I still think it's a frontier. So as I was like working on the report, I posted on X like, hey, can anyone direct me to research the that defines or has analyzed the ROI of podcasts? And like nobody could find anything. I struggled to find it too, right? Like, so we know they're popular and like I like them, and there's a certain segment of like, I don't know, I want to call them fanatics. There's a group of people who are like really, really excited about them, but I'm not convinced it's mainstream. And I couldn't find any research out there that said like, here is the ROI of podcasts for business to business, right? Like people believe in them and there's ones that are popular, but I struggled with like, what's the ROI? So it doesn't mean that they're not something that are powerful medium that people should embrace, but I'm just not sure like, how would I pitch that to the CFO and say like, yeah, we're going to spend a couple million on podcasts. He'd be like, well, great. Well, what would the return be? Right. Like, I don't really know. I don't really know how to define that where I could in other channels. So I still think it's a frontier. I think people should experiment with it. I think they're great as like a media business, or there's people who are just doing really cool content, and it's a great way to like build an audience. But if you're a business and you're trying to make an investment in a channel that you think is going to help drive ROI and bring leads for your sales team, like I struggle with exactly how podcasting will right. do that. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't. I think it's got a place in the funnel, right. But just be smart about like how much you invest.
I love it. Gregory, I'm going to throw you a curveball. Here's a question that I didn't send you. I didn't share with you. It has nothing okay. to do with the report. BrandZen, that's the business. What does BrandZen mean, represent, and why did you go with that name?
Yeah, it's really funny. I was like, I don't know where I came up with that one night. Well, I like endurance sports. I like outdoor cool. sports. And very passionate. Been involved in it for a long time. And a lot of what I was doing, I was very inspired by coaching and the peak performance approach that endurance coaches take. And so I was thinking like, okay, so, you know, a lot of that is how I think about my business, how I talk with customers. And I really went with that as like a tagline, like perform at your peak, because yeah. like I wanted it to be a lot more than just like, hey, we can do great work, or we do have great creative, or we've won awards or whatever it is. I wanted it to be about the customer right. and about them performing at their peak in the same way that like, you know, coaching, whether it's like business coaching or performance coaching related to sport, that's the aim, right? It's like you find right. someone and you make them perform at the very maximum. And so fresh. I loved that as like kind of a spirit of what right. I wanted to represent in the marketplace. And so I took that and I said, well, I'm going to double down on branding, because I think that it's a bit of a, I would say, it's like a, I feel like there's a negative connotation now with that mm-hmm. term. Like, and I still believe in it, just like I believe in full funnel marketing. So I said, I'm going to be a contrarian. I'm going to double down on branding. I love this, endurance sports, outdoor sports, perform at your peak approach. Right. And so I'll call it BrandZen, because what I wanted people to have was just peace of mind. So if you work with me, you'll be confident that like, we're going to take care of it. We're going to get it done. Right. It's going to be fantastic. And you'll be successful.
I like it. Well, Gregory, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate this conversation. If folks want to learn more about you, they can go to wearebrandzen.com. I'll be sure to link to the report as well directly in the show notes so folks can have it. Is there anywhere else that folks should go if they want to learn more about you and connect with you deeper?
Yeah, follow me on X. I am G Kennedy. It's I_AM_G Kennedy.
Awesome. Thanks, Gregory. Really appreciate it.
Hey. Yeah, thank you so much. This has been fantastic, man. And like, I love your work. Keep doing what you're doing. And I will continue to chat with you on X.
Sounds good. I appreciate you.